to record stuff before kind of doing anything, you know.
Well, this is, I mean, speaking as somebody trained in mathematics and you speaking somebody trained in philosophy and physics, you know, propensity science, that's interesting to have those voices in the room saying, yes, we've been trained and we've practiced some of these things, but we see the limits of those masteries. Now, the question would be, what I asked of people in Chicago from all these different disciplines, from music and history and philosophy as well, and then that led to this question, which is, when you reach the edge of your mastery, when you reach the edge of what your discipline affords you, right, the limit, what do you do next? And that was great. They got lots of interesting responses from these senior faculty, senior researchers in their disciplines. Maybe I would invite everybody to respond that way, you know, because the limit of, mm-hmm. right, theory in these different domains, the limit of philosophy.
Can I ask something? Mm-hmm.
Yes.
So here I am, I write poetry. It's not very good, but you're actually supposed to.
I've heard some of your poetry, and I have to say I'm not as really impressed so far.
That's a professional opinion.
I'm a professional literary critic, so I can
say, yeah, I can say that.
You haven't heard any of my poetry.
I've heard one line.
Oh, you're a poet.
That was the title.
That's
no.
Just a film. It's about the poem, you schmuck.
That's the potential.
So some of us are scientists and mathematicians and philosophers in the room, and some of us are in the humanities. So we know who we are. Okay, I mean, it's, you know, Paul and you guys, but we're all one group. I can somehow say what the project is, and for example, in theoretical biology, because I've been doing it. Is there a way of characterizing what you take the project or projects to be that you're taking on? I just like to hear. In other words, So I'd really like to hear everybody say it just briefly. What are you after? Could we take 4 minutes and try to say what we're at? Each of us separately. What are you after?
It's half an hour.
Yeah. Is that worth doing? We've heard everybody's talk.
It'd be fun.
Well, we've heard.
Can you stay half an hour?
But what are you trying to do?
Yeah. He should go first.
Do we want to do this?
I'm not sure if I want to go first, actually.
No, you don't want to go first. We should allow multiple passes. Then.
Huh?
We should allow multiple cycles because, kind of, you know, probably people have more than one way to say it.
It's a genuine question on my part because I'm listening to you guys and I have never heard anything like it before.
Mm-hmm.
And I can be simultaneously amazed and utterly curious about, so what are you up to?
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Did you just say what you were about ten minutes ago?
Yeah.
Okay, that's what you can stand
up. Not as a theoretical biologist. Yeah. As a theoretical biologist until around 10 years ago, what I was up to was things like ensemble models and genetic gradients mm-hmm. and origin of life and mm-hmm. cancer and mm-hmm. cell differentiation and, mm-hmm. and economics and physics mm-hmm. and stuff yeah. like that. And that sort of being in the trenches, theoretical
yep.
scientist.
Yeah.
Was this before you became a poet?
Oh, yeah. No, I became a
poet. Not in between.
You mean it's what shitty poetry I wrote when I was 16.
The girls loved it, so.
Yeah, we're really.
It did its job.
We're really bad Dylan Thomas knockoffs. Yeah. Have I asked an unfair question?
No.
And no, I think we're all just sort of pawing at the ground in our heads about what a sort of concise way of saying it
yeah.
would be, because there's
two and again, to one another.
To one another.
Not specifically to me, I'm asking
yeah, it's,
to say to one another.
It's okay if I jump in just a little bit here.
Yeah.
So for me, this is the difficulty of saying concisely what's at stake for me that brings me into this mix. Is in part because it's the attractions and the pleasures of the conversation that have grabbed me, but they also then resonate with aspects of things that I know that I care about. So as you say that, I think, okay, so what is it that I care about that, that gets me going? Okay, so as you say, multiple iterations, so I'll just throw a couple of things out. So this question of affordances is really important to me as a cultural anthropologist. Just this is insider baseball, but there. For generations now, cultural anthropology has been stuck between the kind of mode of ethnography that's utter idiosyncrasy and theory. and it doesn't have a good conceptual apparatus for getting after the ways in which the lived experience of this creature anthropos that anthropologists are supposed to be studying, in fact, are always indelibly marked by a kind of singularity. That's why I love the inductive global. But in fact, these are formations which are always in connection and conversation with lots of other things, not least for reasons of historicity. We now live, as we know, in a kind of global moment in which lots of things are pulling on lots of other things. And so there's a need in the art form of anthropology for a kind of generality. Okay, where's the source of the generality? We could look lots of places, but one of them is, what is the conceptual repertoire by way of which we can reason in a particular manner? And it seems to me that on this question of limitations and affordances, mm-hmm. that one of the things that I'm interested in anthropology are ways of naming the kind of objects and processes that go on in these social settings that allow you to capture some of the features of them that are the stuff that we've talked about. So that's one, that's just methodological. But then sort of materially from yourself, for me, I have for a long time both been fascinated by and irritated by the way in which living things mm-hmm. get imagined within biotechnical apparatuses. Mm-hmm. And the fact that the kinds of questions which a philosopher might name as problems of holism or even vitalism get covered over by the kind of machinery of this world, and that the justification for getting rid of those kinds of questions or rendering them out of bounds is the algorithmic presumption about the nature of living things. And so last time when we got together, I knew this is a group of people that I would want to just hear from and interact with, and then Stu says, look, I think that there's something about living things that's non-algorithmic. You say somewhere along the way and you're talking, you go on, and I'm like,
yep.
Because in fact, this is precisely in the work that I do, is that there's a presumption of a kind of digital imagination that is making an indelible mark on the way in which biology is being thought and worked on and worked over and invented and made within these real world apparatuses. So it's not just philosophy of biology, although it's that too. And the question of what are the conceptual repertoires and modes of reasoning that will allow me to even see that that's going on, let alone bring it to a level of visibility that I can articulate something about how it operates and what its limitations consist in. Let alone, then I think more significantly, be able to provide some kind of intervention which opens up a different set of possibilities, which for me as an anthropologist is quite different, quite difficult, because the vocational limitations of anthropology is, oh yeah, well the natives are doing this thing, isn't that interesting? But in fact, part of the energy of this group is to say, no, like, we can imagine some other set of possibilities. It's not just naming the limitations of the existing set of practices. It's opening up the possibilities, it's affording a new set of possibilities. And so this collective then allows me to begin to imagine what a different sort of vocational practice is in terms of a constructive intervention that would, insofar as some of my interlocutors are the biotechnologists themselves, be able to name a different set of possibilities than the kinds of things that they're doing in their work.
I want to make a short commentary on this because I'd rather talk about it than talk about my own work for a second. I think this is a great description of not just this sweet spot I was talking about. The way you were framing it was, over here we have singularities which are, oh wow, they're all automatically interesting. And the antidote is, we have this global thing, it's like, oh well, those are all subservient to some master principle. The sweet spot is in between these two things. But what I like about the way you described it is how that then opens up, and not doing that precludes opening up different ways of thinking the problem and the relationship between the two ends of the problem that you just described. Right. Nice.
So I'm going to drop something really quickly because I have to leave pretty soon. But and it's going to be really short. So part of my frustration with history has been it's been a methodological issue, and I've been trying to find ways of combining historical content in with the methodological issue to rethink how causality and time operate in history. And because of this, I've done a lot of work beginning with thinking about notions of emergence in history, thinking about ideas of simultaneity, thinking about ideas of density, singularity, what's a singularity in historical framework. So I'm very playful with my methods, right? But then what ends up becoming important for me for the content is to then look at how those methods then interrelate with how potentia for biological beings have been conceived. And that's basically my project.
That was incredibly succinct.
Yeah.
Yes.
And I would say, just to riff on that last point, that this question of the potential for biological beings, taken up in a mode that's informed by the whatever this collective way of reasoning is moving toward, this beyond complexity.
Yes.
I think offers both a different way of reading stuff that's already exists, the actualities of the biological science.
That's right.
But also inflecting the potentias in new ways. So there's, back to your, this, the link between your method and your substance.
This is what a historical project is interesting still for me.
Yeah. I mean, I guess I could say something really quickly. Sorry.
Did you call Uber or do you have your car? Did you rent a car?
No, I can hear a couple more.
Did you rent a car or you have a car?
I'm going to get a Lyft. Okay. And they seem to be around.
They're all over.
Got it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sorry.
I think, and I'll just say that this is really just what brings me into this. I feel like I have, there are many dimensions, various aspects of the kind of work I do that don't necessarily fit in to this collective, to this group, but I do think one of them does for sure. And that's really, lately I've been fundamentally invested in thinking about, and I'm glad you brought up the question of limitations, because I think that I'm very interested in the limitations, but also possibilities that are generated when we think about philosophy's relationship to biology. Mm-hmm. And you know, there's very specific history of how it is that philosophers, the philosophy of biology and philosophy of science, particularly the philosophy of biology, has been sort of wrapped up in a particular kind of metaphysics that is, for me, deeply problematic. And I'm actually really interested in thinking about, you know, how it is that philosophers, that when they talk about biology, are doing this kind of, are a part of this modern epistemic practice, where it's a kind of grounding exercise. And I'm really interested in peeling philosophy back and seeing what its limitations are, but what are its affordances when it's talking about biology, right? So a lot of the work that I'm doing now on basically what is a biological concept, it's really trying to flesh out what is the relationship between biology and philosophy at the end of the day. Mm-hmm. And is there some sort of shared territory that we haven't actually explored, mm-hmm. where one doesn't look like it's trying to explain the other or whatever, right? Mm-hmm. And so this is where my work on Isabel Stengers coming out of Alfred North Whitehead, that's where it really becomes valuable, is thinking about this kind of, you know, these domains of knowledge production. So, mm-hmm.
just a quick response on that. It seems like this is, Kang Yim is insistent about this relationship between philosophy and biology as something that does never go away. The conceptual life of biology is always related to the experimental practices of biology. And the living thing, what's at stake about the question, what is the form of the living thing, is always simultaneously that thing which I'm studying in my lab, and also me as a living being who's studying that thing in my lab. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, all of us in different ways participate in some dimension of that, which, you know, doesn't ask it. Obviously, only re-invokes the problem, but
I mean, Kang Yim steps on the life of the concept is amazing, biological concept. That's great. Yeah.
And there's an insistence, and this is back to the beyond complexity, an insistence to say, no, whatever concepts we have need to be biological concepts, even we don't know yet how to name a biological concept. That matters to me, because I think it's not just, as Stu said earlier, that complexity theory has gotten us to here and now we want to go here. It's that it's done so much that we can now see what it doesn't do. And right. One of the things it doesn't do is it can't think living things as living things.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And so the question of the biological concept is a kind of golden ring with regard to, like, what is this mode of reasoning that allows us to think about biology in a different manner?
Mm-hmm. Should I try to think?
Please.
But I mean, I've been doing science for 50 years, so there's all that shit or stuff or poetry or whatever. I'm sort of writing a new book. I'm supposed to be writing a new book. It's under contract to Oxford, and I've written the first draft, and it's 80 pages. And Oxford's worried that it's not long enough. So I'm going to use big letters.
Lots of diagrams.
Yeah, I don't know how to solve the problem, but it's, I think it's done. Maybe done.
You know, in humanities, is we use big words.
Anyway, the book's about what you know, I think we all tend to do the stuff at any point that we think is the most important thing to do. So I'm doing that too. And here's what the book is about. Its title, tentative title is, including Beyond, A World Beyond Physics, The Origin and Evolution of Life. Well, that's a lot for 80 pages, right? So basically what it says is, here's my best, Stu Kaufman's best guess about how to get life started, in the sense of starting with nothing much and ending it with protocells. Then the second part of the book is saying, once you've got protocells, they evolve, you know, the screwdriver argument, they evolve in a way that you can't restate. Therefore, there is this becoming beyond complexity that the biosphere is fucking doing, and there are no entailing laws for it, which I've written in the past. And furthermore, there are an estimated 10 to the 22 solar systems in the universe. If life is abundant, this becoming is happening all over the universe, and it's beyond physics. So that's what I'm struggling with now.
And that's where the UFOs come from.
Well, they do.
Yeah.
No joke. And don't even this is where they come. This is fucking reality.
I know. Scott's within 15 miles of where they're going to arrive.
Now you fucked it up. Scott's now that's the one thing
I wish I had been there for that really famous Phoenix UFO sighting. That must have been crazy.
But
you know the one I'm talking about? The huge one?
Oh yeah, I know all about it.
Yeah.
It was bullshit. You know, they covered it up with the big one, but there was actually a small
little one.
Yeah, a smaller one that no one knows what that was.
To go back to what both of you guys said, and you also said, Philip, however we got protocells, and protocells became, that is the onset of the biological, it's that which can't be said by complexity, it's life itself, in Robert Rosen's phrase, except that it's not just mathematical, it's physical. Mm-hmm. The protocells become. Mm-hmm. They do.
But that's where the bubbles, the talk you gave in Santa Fe, that's where the soap bubbles were so good.
That's right.
The liposomes, because that gets you from the physics of energy work and constraint to the closure that's required to get to bootstrap recursivity.
Right.
And then it's
absolutely
fucking off to the races.
Right. And then
I was like, he's D-Black boxed it. Mm-hmm. It was all about soap bubbles.
It was all about soap bubbles. And I should have said, that's how it is.
Is that going to be in the book?
Yeah, sure.
Okay.
It's Dave Beamer and
sure.
and a bunch of other people.
Yeah.
I mean, part of the excitement of what you just described.
What?
Part of the excitement for me of what you just described, just the elegance of it, is coming out of anthropology to biology. My intuition all along has been the lessons learned in anthropology about the squirrely nature of human cultures and the inability ultimately to pin down the differences between them through some master theory that could predict in advance what a culture is supposed to look like. Like that failure is tied somehow into the sort of non-prestatable nature of human communities. And I've always had this intuition that actually something like that's happening in microbiology as well.
It is.
And my pleasure and excitement about working with biologists is the fact that there are these master craftsmen who are building stuff that works and that can be known, which nonetheless have some of these dimensions of squirreliness that are so idiosyncratic and irregular.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Mike, you want to take that?
Yeah, I mean, this is nowhere near as deep as what you guys are saying. Because all I really want to do, or I'm trying to do, is to contribute to the vitalization of speculative philosophy as a robust paradigm in philosophy, as a pushback against all the trends in philosophy today, which I find to be problematic for so many different reasons. And then more than that, I guess what I really enjoy doing is contributing, or what I really want to do is try to contribute to a vital pushback and counterpunch, I'll use that word, against reductive materialism, which I think has infected almost every type of inquiry one can think of. And not only every type of inquiry, every type of praxis in the world. It's fucking everything up. And it scares me. I mean, you know, and any kind of pushback against that, I want to be a part of. And I feel that whether or not there's any success or momentum, I don't really care. I like the idea of contributing to a counterpunch against that. You know,
not least because that counterpunch is can now be sadly now needs to be aimed not just at the pointy-headed departments in academics, but we live in a world whose material infrastructures are built off of technologies that are driven by people who have this feel for the world.
Yeah, people are social matter. That's what people are to today. To the people who run our society, we are social matter, and we are nothing but that. And there has to be a vital resistance against that. And the weird thing is, we're happy to be reduced to social matter so often. Yeah. We're so comfortable being reduced
to that.
We're
comfortable, if not happy.
Whether it's reducing our lives to how we present them on Facebook, or whether it's reducing communication to email and then to texting, knowing how much we're giving up, that becomes our preference. We like being reduced for some weird reason.
It's so funny how literary scholars now get off on that too.
Yeah.
Oh my God. The computational humanities.
A
great book. A great book just came out in my series by Karsten Strathausen, the chair of German at Missouri. It's called Bioaesthetics, and it is a freaking carpet bombing.
Yeah.
Of this stuff. Of cognitive poetics, all this stuff.
Cognitive aesthetics. Neural aesthetics. Aesthetics.
This is absolute crap.
Human computing crap. And it's everyone gets so tickled because now you have, physicists reading, climate fiction and stuff. But that's what they want to do. They want to model, how much does this, how much. Or they want to quantify how fiction affects the general public.
Oh, oh my God.
That's what they're doing. I saw three panels.
We could just call the manifesto, this is the bullshit we hate.
Yeah.
The bullshit we hate.
Yeah. I hate to say it, but that actually...
It's like, Mike would like to go first.
This is killing all of us, I want to be a part of the punch.
Yeah,
it's not nothing. Yesterday, when we were sort of, limbering up, and we finally decided to record, but when we were limbering up yesterday, once the energy got going, it roared, in part because of the pleasure of being freed from having to deal with the stuff that we hate.
Yeah.
Or at least some partial freedom.
It's true.
So, Shimui, I don't think you've done it yet. I'm going to have to take off. It would be nice for me to get closure.
When I read that passage in the last part of my presentation, it gets embedded in there somehow. But, I still love mathematics. Okay, I don't do it, but I always, always love mathematics. So it's like maybe I can hear the love of molecular biology when you talk. There's that. Okay. But then the thing is, when I had to work, doing stuff, it was with computers. So then I thought for 10 years, how computers are so powerful and so useless at the same time for doing creative mathematics, for creating new mathematics, like the way that mathematicians think and invent, that I was pointing to. Okay, so that's surprising to non-mathematicians often because they, you're mathematicians, don't you love the computers? And no, actually, we have no relationship to computers, actually. The work that we do most of the time has no relation to calculation, no relation. Right, so that's one. That's a negative. On the other hand, we look around and we see all those justifications made in the name of mathematics, in the name of proof and rigor. But it's not really done that way. It's just in the name of, right? So the kind of borrowed aura from mathematics that was borrowed by computer science over 50 years. Okay. Now, what computer science actually does is just take a very tiny corner of mathematics. Takes a tiny corner, a little bit of linear algebra, a little bit of matrix, and that's about it, except for certain parts. And then they go around and build those machines. And I think Gavin expressed it very well. I share very much your reaction to how computation has gone into. Actually, I should be very specific. What kind of computation? Turing equivalent computation is implemented in digital computers. Very specific, that kind of computation.
Quite important.
That kind of computation, all right? And I was part of that. Okay, I was part of the generation of people who wrote these cool programs. But those programs were all speculative. Those were composed in the 80s when it was not clear what a personal computer was. And before me, Alto Holt, back in the 1950s, who I mentioned before, for him, he was the first generation of programmers. His PhD was in mathematical linguistics from Harvard. He said there's no such thing as a computer science. There's no computer science. And over the span of 30 years, from when he started to when I met him, he said that computation became more and more opaque, even to him, who's one of the founders of computer science. Well, computer science became a professionalization of a set of speculative exercises with these kinds of digital machines that made them opaque in the very course of professionalizing the disciplines of computer science and engineering. So that opacity is part of power, is part of power. Okay, this is part of the rant, okay, the rant part of it. On the positive side is, you know, I actually do think of mathematics as I've always thought of mathematics, creating of mathematics as more of a poetic activity, but not in the sense of poetry. So I am interested in
poesis in a broader sense.
Okay,
yeah.
So like,
poetics.
I will talk with Kerry Moore over the years and try to make this more clear in my own head. Okay, but I really always thought it was more of a poetic gesture, but both poetic and poetic, but not in the same sense as poetry, written language. But okay, fine. Now, so I have a different way of thinking and doing it. Okay, in my talk with people, I have this kind of. It's not just saying, "Oh, this is elegant proof." Okay, it's just there's a certain. Anyway, and certain people had that sense, like Gilles Châtelet, Deleuze, or his people he spoke with, and Zadamea. Some people like that. Okay. Whereas Badiou uses mathematics as a hammer, but other people use it as poetic. And I'm of that sort. There are very few people like that. Very, very few. René Thom. Okay, René Thom,
yeah.
Okay, is sort of like that too. So there's very few people that are like that. Okay. So I would like to see how to do that. You know, I like to pursue that kind of work. But I want to find students, I want to find people to carry that on, you know, to how to do it as a poetic form. And that cannot be mechanized. That can never, in fact, there are proofs that that cannot be mechanized, right? That's a good old incompleteness theorem back in the early part of the 20th century. Now comes in politics. Okay, so yes, there's mathematics pursued as an art form, as a poetic form, okay? There are examples of that kind of thing. I'm by no means a master, just my way of entering the pleasure of mathematics, okay? Now, politics. When I go talk to policy people doing policy on technology or who want to mechanize metrics of human activity, et cetera, I say to them, I quote to them these theorems. Godot incompleteness theorem, or Giuseppe's theorem about how larger databases contain spurious correlations. It's a theorem, or Sari's theorem that I just sent to you all about the intrinsic chaos of any economic system in one and two products. I mean, these are the theorems. And all my 25, 30 years, these arguments are correct, but they don't have power. You know, they can, you know, they're less and less convincing because people don't really think anymore in terms of reason and argument as much, right? It maybe 50 years ago, those had bite. Those theorems had bite. So when Godot proved his incomplete results, that was a shock, worldwide shock, you know. So I'm interested politically, you know, in how to construct alternatives. It's sort of like what you were saying. That's why I did all this laboratory work for 15 years. I want to construct alternatives that use computation differently for poetic gesture, right? Underneath, it's informed by these new kinds of different ways of thinking mathematically, poetically, but on the surface, it appears to people as art. It appears to people as, you know, music and dance and things like that. But underneath, there's that, you know, both a new, different way of doing mathematics synthetically, so to speak, you know, and poetically, and a critique
right.
of the way that digital computers have been implemented, architectively implemented. Yeah. Anyway.
I mean, that point you're making, Shelley, about theorems that are quote-unquote true but don't have power, it's a little bit like what Foucault says about you can be true without being in the truth. That's a hugely, hugely important thing to keep in mind, I think, for anybody, including this group, who's doing kind of high-powered theoretical.
Yeah.
You know, there's one part of the, and sometimes the exhilarating part of all this is the abstract, you know, theoretical part of it. But then the second part is like, well, so what and for whom?
Yeah.
Under with what stakes, under what conditions?
And in fact, I think all of us have that love of the sublime and the theoretical dimension in part because we keep running into things, as we're in the world, as we say, that are counterindicators about the stuff that we know are true.
Yeah.
And so, in fact, it's hard for us to move back to the use cases, let's say. But in fact, that's actually where the irritant is. I mean, the reductive materialists, they're all sitting in their closet writing their journals, who would give a shit? And in fact, we see the power of those ideas ramifying out. And as a result, like utterly reducing the possibility space as a result of the dominance of that mode of existing in the world.
Mm-hmm. And Stu, you know that for 15 years, the topological media labs module was to my laboratory, which was started in 2001 for study of gesture in responsive environments.
Mm-hmm.
The module, the subtitle for that was when I turned to people in engineering and policy, was we are looking for ways to construct responsive environments that are rich, not complex. I was thinking explicitly of complexity science.
You were.
Yes, because already then I was saying from mathematical principles that
you're coming beyond complexity.
There were sort of limits to the models. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so I was very happy to meet you. So it was, and that's still the motto for that I borrowed for Synthesis Center. We're interested in building built environment, augmentations of built environments that are rich, but not complex.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Well, thank you guys. I'm gonna have to take off.
Okay.
Thank you. Thanks for lunch.
It was a joy.
It's been a real pleasure.
Yeah, really been a great thinking with you guys.
Good seeing you, buddy.
Yeah, this is my favorite relationship.
Have a rich trip back.
Have a safe trip back.
Yeah.
All
right.
Okay,
let's
hey, man.
Safe travels, bro. Okay.
Hey, all the best. Yeah. Great to see you.
Yeah,
hey, man.
Thank you.
As always, we'll see you this spring, I hope. Yeah,
definitely.
Another conference.
Enjoy your layover, baby.
Yeah. And give Kamala my best.
I'll do that, Adam.
Just because the last couple of days been so into this, like I really didn't prep.
Yeah.
Like one of the classes, the seminar, that one I can't bluff.
Right.
Yeah. So I was reading Marcia Iliada's The Sacred and the Profane.
Oh, nice.
So I'm doing this genealogy of how philosophy and anthropology get pulled out of religion, get segregated in religious studies. Why do these become two different ways of thinking about whatever this bucket of stuff is that gets called religion?
Right.
And it's the pro seminar. It's like the first class they have to take.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So I want them to have a kind of a clear genealogy of the ways in which this stuff gets divided out.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Why is it that Levi Brill's talking to Henri Bergson, but now the philosophers reading Bergson, but the anthropologists aren't?
Right.
You know, how do we get there?
Right.
So it's like really cool stuff, but like cramming in the midst of all of this.
It's gotta be rough.
Yeah, it's intense. And then the poor undergraduates, man, I'm teaching this really hard stuff, the really cool stuff. It's like 80 freshmen, basically.
Is this your, like, introduction to religion?
Yes, like religion in the modern world.
Wow.
Yeah, it's a cool class.
Awesome.
And I like have them read like five books that are just like are mind benders.
Yeah.
And one of them is this book, A Season in Mecca, by this anthropologist Abdellah Hammoudi, who was at Princeton for years. He's emeritus now. But he, like, the last great book he's going to write is Anthropology of the Hajj.
Oh, wow.
And he grew up a Muslim in Morocco, and then, like, he's very much a kind of colonial elite. He goes to the Lycée, he goes and studies with the Lacanians in Paris, and becomes this very fancy anthropologist of the psychology of religion, and he's at the end of his career, and he's going to go back and he's an anthropologist of the Hajj, and he fucking gets caught in this.
Oh, the stampede thing?
No, the anthropologists have this term to be caught means the logic of the world you're entering in takes you over, and you can't do the anthropology anymore.
Whoa.
Because the sort of the mode of subjectivity is this secular elite who's going to watch these people do these things.
Yeah.
But in fact, he's from that neighborhood.
Right.
And so like everybody hears his accent. And so all of the boundaries break down.
Yeah.
And so it's this, I end the class with this book because I want the students to see that the kind of malaise and unsettledness that he suffers is in fact the experience of religion in the modern world. And so they, we're all sort of caught in these weird spaces.
Yeah, that's really interesting.
Religion in the modern world is this unsettling in which you can both be moved by it and held by it.
That's really awesome. Yeah. That's really great.
I think this is hugely, I think this is hugely important. That's why I keep bringing it up about one of the kind of social ramifications of what we're doing here, you know, is because, you know, New York Times had a great magazine, had a great cover story a few years ago. Basically, the story was, you know, these secular elites like us who live in the West, we think like we're the normal ones.
Yes, that's right.
But actually, like, 80% of the people in the world believe in some higher power.
Yeah.
Like, you're actually the weirdos.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
So, you know, how to think about going into the world, doing what we do, and trying to make sense of, well, what is it that pushes people in these directions? Yeah. What are they grasping for, reaching for, that all of the theories that Mike hates have created in a way, you know, didn't invent, but have like ramped it up, you know, and
ratcheted it up.
Yeah.
And what are the affordances? What affordances are we lacking? Not only with regard to understanding that stuff, but building a world that isn't built on the worlds that Mike is irritated by.
Yeah.
So the mindfulness folks and company, they're just as much secular moderns, and they say, they're like, wow, I'm not religious, man.
Yeah.
I'm not having anything
totally,
to do with that.
Yeah.
And yet, they want life to be vitalistic. They don't really know what that means.
No.
But they intuit that it must have something to do with enchantment. If if the alternative is reductive materialism, and that's disenchantment, then I damn well want enchantment. And I want a set of practices by way of which I find meaning again in the world without that being an alternative to science.
Right.
Like,
that's right.
Science tells me it can't generate meaning, so fine then, I'm going to generate meaning somewhere else. Except that all the material they're using, so you listen to one of these spiritual entrepreneurs, and it's like some weird little mix mashup of physics and brain scans.
Oh, you know what I did? You know what I did last week?
Right?
Yeah.
My friend David Wills.
How to find vortex and jump into one.
My friend David Wills, you know, who's basically a Derridian, introduced me to Derrida, translates Derrida, teaches French at Brown. But he was in town. He got a grant to do this project on the Rothko Chapel. So he goes into Rothko Chapel every day, spends like an hour, same time every day. And the project is, let's just see what pops into my head and what I want to write about in response to this experience.
Great, great project.
Yeah. And so,
it's
in all sorts of, so, you know, then he ended up going off in all these directions that he had no idea he was going to go in. But while he was, we have one of the biggest mega churches in the world in Houston called Lakewood Baptist Churches, where Joel Osteen preaches.
Oh, yeah.
So he said, I want to go to Lakewood. And I said, you know, I've never been. I'd love to
Let's go.
So we went to Lakewood. And it's in the basketball arena that where the NBA team, the Houston Rockets, used to play. The seats like 16,000 people.
Yeah.
And it's like, it starts with like a miniature rock concert, a band of about 20 people, 9 vocalists, 4 electric guitars, drums, light shows, smoke, the whole thing, you know. And then there's like different stages of it. And then he finally comes out and preaches.
Yeah.
And of course, he's had like 7 or 8 New York Times bestsellers.
Yeah.
And they're this weird mix of like fundamentalism and entrepreneurial self-help is what he's
exactly
known for.
Right.
But the interesting thing about the interesting distinction I want to make, and I think he's a great rhetorician.
Yeah,
so he'll take some little turn of phrase in the Bible and he'll say, you know, so-and-so, he didn't say maybe grace will follow him. He said surely. You know, so he'll like take something like that and create this whole.
Yeah, yeah.
But the thing that's interesting about this, what's going on with religion in the United States of that type, is it demands nothing of you. All you have to do is show up and get your therapy
and be affirmed.
It's entertaining.
And be affirmed and leave.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And that's where I think making these kinds of distinctions that you're interested in is really, really important as a way of not saying, oh, it's all bullshit.
Yeah.
But beginning to parse this a little bit more carefully, you know, and of course I was like, I'm coming back next week. Shit, this guy deserves every dollar. You know, it's like, and the other thing that's interesting though, in the service I said to David, I said, look around.
Yeah.
This is not a bunch of white Trump supporters. The demographic in this room
yeah. is probably overwhelmingly did not vote for Trump. Is a complete demographic yeah. smear exactly. of yeah. the city of Houston. Yeah. Where else do you see that in the public sphere? Answer, right. almost nowhere.
And yeah, almost nowhere on Sunday mornings, which and is typically the most segregated moment.
Exactly,
in life.
Exactly. So that in itself is like, you know, something interesting is going on.
You know, it's it airs after this week with George Stephanopoulos leaves in Sacramento. So like at the tail end of that, I'll catch, it comes on. And I know what it is. And I'm like, oh, this asshole. Okay, I saw him on 60 Minutes. And something about, you end up watching the characters about by, you're like, what the fuck? He's mesmerizing.
Yeah.
And it's because it's look, you know what it is, you're right. It asks nothing of you.
No.
It's very, it's prosperity theology.
Yes.
Which is very, okay.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
So that you walk out of there loaded with confirmation bias. You just know
yes,
that
yes.
you're
yes.
looking for things to confirm the message.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
you think your life.
Hey, it's the law of attraction, man.
Yeah,
law
yeah.
It's the law of attraction. If you think abundance, you find abundance.
Yeah. But here's the connection to the.
Well, I got to tell you about being anointed. Yeah.
Because, so the connection to the social matter thing for me.
This is what we have to do. We have to put on a church. We have to start a church.
And
pass
hey,
also Genesis.
Pass a bucket around. That's the key. No, but what I was going to say is the reason why it's seductive is the same reason why we're so happy to be reduced to social matter. If you think about it, all these technologies that want to reduce you to data, right? And they sell you shit.
And they do reduce you to data.
And they do. And they you buy stuff so that you are willingly reducible to data. Why?
And you're shedding way more
yes.
now that you've got the...
Yes.
Are we all talking about Fitbit?
Yes, Fitbit.
My
yes.
wife
right,
just got Fitbit.
You know,
it pisses me off.
But why?
Yes.
It's no different than
she's taking a shower and accidentally
loses
it.
What?
If you think
yeah.
accidentally
it.
Lose it when she's
do
taking
this,
a shower.
And good things will befall you.
And
right.
it's
a new
economy. And it's an economy.
And
this will become your super ego
yes.
linked to this, and you're not going to have to worry
exactly.
about it.
Exactly. Exactly.
So one of the things I have my students do is to watch somebody like Joel, Osteen. And I have them watch it with the sound off on YouTube.
Yeah.
And then I have them watch TED Talks with the sound off on YouTube.
Yeah.
And I say, why are TED Talks powerful? Mm-hmm. You think they're powerful because these are the celebrity technologists who are telling you that the next iPhone is going to fix poverty. But the reason it works for you is because as an American, you know the genre.
Mm-hmm.
You know that it doesn't matter what you're being told because you already know what the truth is and the truth is going to set you free. But you need to be reminded.
Mm-hmm.
You need to be reminded by somebody who's a charismatic figure who brings it back down to your life.
Mm-hmm.
Like that's what you're watching when you're seeing a TED Talk.
Yeah.
Now, of course, the secret truth is, like, that's straight out of the Silicon Valley, man.
Right.
Like, that's not just, like, this weird little genre that gets mixed up with Hollywood.
No, that's like Steve Jobs whenever he goes out to talk about the new thing.
The product release is
the
evangelist.
Yeah, it is.
Well, Stuart Brand, I was talking about, you know, with the Long Now Foundation, at the end of his TED Talk, there's a whole conference on TEDx about de-extinction. Really interesting, a couple hours.
What's de-extinction? R-extinction?
No, de-extinction.
De-extinction.
Yeah, and Stuart Brand started this from the Long Now Foundation. And at the end of his talk, he's almost crying.
Yeah.
And he says, and we want to welcome these beings back to a world that misses them.
Here's the opportunity.
I mean, it is so televangical.
Wow.
Like,
amazing.
You know, yeah, no, well, just, it's just the, it's the same rhetorical mode.
What are the beings that are being welcomed?
These animals that they want to bring back through de-extinction. So like a passenger pigeon, the woolly mammoth, the you know, the Tasmanian tiger,
T-Rex.
Yeah, the T-Rex.
You know, one of the things they say,
Stuart Kaufman.
One of the things I say to my anthropologist friends is people in anthropology have been insistent for 20 years that they want they study material culture, material religion, and they want to disavow this stuff,
right?
Because they want to say, well, look, it's just rhetoric, it's just warmed over Protestantism. I said, no, like, this is a form of life that has remnants, survivals of other stuff, but it's being reconfigured to produce something that's distinctive today, and there's a lot of work to be done to answer the question, what is it?
Right. Well, what's interesting is the YouTube and the TED Talks and the TEDx and whatever that sort of...
The media forums.
The media forums. And they actually, I mean, they do have the same form, which is amazing, right?
Yeah.
So it's not, I mean, this is not just about religion, obviously, you know?
Yeah. Just a very nice abstract TED Talk. Have you seen it? It's just all the formal components of the TED Talk.
Mm-hmm. I've heard about
it. It's very cool. this person says, what? You know, and he labels himself, you know, they're cool, do them, and then this is the time to put up a big slide, put up another slide, put up a slide of the planet Earth to show the holistic. It goes through the whole
thing. Yeah. Well, now, I wish Philip was here because he did a TEDx talk, and it was,
yeah.
it was
and they do all the training, don't they?
Yeah, they train, it's traumatizing for you.
Oh, no, I did the first TEDx Houston, I did one of them, and it was... It was so weird.
Don't they make you inhabit a whole like form?
Oh yeah. No. There's a whole
formula.
There's a formula that you adhere to,
it means it's a practice. And well, it may not be a religion, but that's salvational.
Yep. And the main thing it does, I mean, I noticed in the one I did because it was an all day thing. We had people doing all kinds of stuff. But the main thing it does is it has this total flattening effect.
Yep.
Across all these often incommensurable ways of thinking about stuff and coming at stuff. You know, the machine itself just, you know, flattens this landscape in the name of a kind of experience.
It could be
a televangelist.
Or Richard Dawkins.
I mean,
that's really important.
How long is guys? Have you guys ever seen Deepak Chopra?
Yeah.
He pisses me off so much. Am I the only one?
I'm fascinated.
You were emailing with him in that Matters of Mind group. You remember?
I do. And I asked Deepak how, if everything is mind, he explained the fossil record.
Yeah, I know.
And
I know.
What did he say?
He didn't answer.
No,
then he goes on giving the same spiel.
You should send him the Bill Hicks stand-up routine on that. When they talk to creationists about fossils, and he says, you know what their answer always is? He's like, God's testing us. He's like, doesn't God have better shit to do? I mean, like, to fuck with us, you know? What kind of God is this, you know?
That whole group is so frustrating. That's why I bailed on it. I was like, Stan, and like, you know, it's like, you guys just...
Stan is unending. Actually, he's a very kind guy.
No.
He's not...
I thought he was, but I actually worked with him at Berkeley as a result of all this work, and he no. And then Ruth told me stuff about him too.
Oh, really?
Like, okay. Yeah.
But see, I do think this is a big challenge for us, though. This to intervene in this in a way that does require that you actually do some work and know something.
Yes.
Yeah. And you're not just mindful. You have to like learn stuff ways that reshape your relationship to the world.
Yeah.
It's that demand that the audience for is shrinking and has been shrinking,
yes,
partly because of people like Joel Osteen for the last 40 years.
Yeah,
you know, and you see how it affects undergraduate populations. Yeah. Like, you try to teach Faulkner. This is too fucking hard. It's supposed to be hard.
Yeah.
It's too hard.
Yeah.
What are you doing to me?
This says something about us as a group. We're awfully refined. We're awfully, you know, almost in God's, in Einstein's sense of raffinier, which means...
We have to remember this.
We sort of know what we're trying to do. Teeny bit. Now the question is, who's going to give a shit and why?
Yeah.
Okay, like when Complexity got started within the Institute, we didn't know it. Within 4 years, the place was world famous. Everybody thought it was the hottest thing since fried bread. We would like something that doesn't have to go with that kind of alacrity and fantastic success, because that's rare. But we want something that will grow, right? Right? And we're a pretty weird little group.
Yeah.
You're getting an argument from me on that one. Yeah.
Well, each of us is not weird, but as a collection, we're weird.
There's two different ways. Michael Neymark was this big shot tech artist, told me once that instead of the moonshot type of tech art, you know, like a Bill Viola type, whatever, maybe a better model for could be a baker baking bread so that everybody eats bread every day. And so it's an everyday thing, you know, that people all want. But it's not like, you know, going to the
Eiffel Tower. Great image.
Well, this is what I mean, the point of contact with what I was talking about with Gaiman is actually art. I mean, art, there's a way in which art, and I'm not talking about for professional people involved in art like you, but there's also a way in which art doesn't require you to know anything. You walk into a gallery, You know, you walk into some art space, you know, and a lot of the people I see in these spaces don't know shit about contemporary art. They don't have any idea the genealogies of what this type of work comes out of. Let's take installation art, for example. They're just in there going like,
hey, wow, look
whoa,
that.
Cool. Yeah. But the difference between that non-knowledge and the religion not is the religion non-knowledge opens onto a bunch of answers. And the art experience opens onto a bunch of questions.
Yeah.
Like, what the fuck was that?
Yeah.
What just happened? You know? And that's already answered for you. So those kinds of distinctions, I think, are really important to just in thinking about audience and topos and setting and just, you know.
Well, it's a very different economy, right?
Oh,
because,
totally.
Because this economy, I mean, you know, you give it your attention. It's just like, it's like an attention economy, right? You give it your attention and you're actually going to get something in return right away. Right,
yeah.
If you walk out and you feel better and you go about your daily life or whatever, you know, what you're going to get out of fucking installation art is fucking confusion.
No, and it's existentially real. I mean, I was watching the people in the building. It, the shit
yeah,
is ex- effectively existentially
same,
real. People aren't just play acting.
There's,
like,
there's the same story, a similar story can be told about, you know, when they have a convention up in Sedona or, you know, when the Landmark Forum has some big event, there is this restlessness among people who want to live in a vital world.
Well, so this reminds me of when I took, so we have the, they're coming in 2 weeks. Maya and Nick, very old friends of Shane Way's, good friends of mine, we're doing this art project with them, and they're these amazing art and design practitioners. It's like, it's a way of being, it's a lifestyle and so forth, right? You know, but you know, they are these strange kind of, I mean, I think she's actually Wiccan. And she is Wiccan, and
Wiccan
kind of animist. What's that?
Wiccan or Wiccan?
Wiccan.
Oh.
Like a witch. Yeah. Feminist, eco-feminist Wiccan. And we took her up to Sedona. And she was so, Ron and I took her up to Sedona, she was so upset at the way this stuff gets branded.
Yeah.
And it was like, she's Croatian. She's like, and she goes, and she goes into this, because we were just kind of like laughing or whatever, we went into one of these, you know, like these hippie,
crystal,
you know,
shops.
Crystal shop or whatever. You know, and she's like, look at, I want to tear this place apart.
Yes.
And you know, I was laughing and stuff like that. She's like, this is not fun.
No, it's not.
You know, and this is because this is a hardcore for her, a hardcore spiritual practice.
Right.
It involves her
that's
art
right.
design practice.
Well, that's right.
And
it's like when a good Catholic watches Joel Austin, you're like, what the fuck? No, that's not
that's
what
right.
it means.
No,
it's not
that's
what
right.
It,
that's
no,
right.
I know. It's,
well,
it's,
and right. And when my students ask me, well, what's wrong with people going to Lakewood Church and having this experience? And I'm like, Nuremberg?
Yeah.
That's what's wrong with it. Now we can have a conversation about needing to know something.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know?
Can you fill that out? What's the relationship between that and...
Well, it's, you know, you can't just have an uncritical affirmation of mass hysteria, because that can go in any direction, you know, politically.
Yeah,
and,
yeah, that's exactly.
You know, and so at that point you have to start making distinctions about what is it we're doing here, and, you know...
And then also our critical work is what are the pathologies such that this is the antidote?
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, why is it? I used to see this in San Francisco during the dot-com boom. People would show up at a religious service, and like spiritually, if we can use that language, they like stagger in, and they're looking for some like spiritual equivalent of Xanax that'll like get them through the next week, because everybody's like talking this happy California
right.
innovation talk,
right.
while meanwhile like exploiting the shit out of everybody and themselves. They're like working these 80-hour weeks, which is supposed to be a badge of honor, but it's because they like they don't know if it's going to work, and
right.
you know.
Right.
Like, they're spread so thin.
Right.
And so there's this way in which the turning to these seemingly easy experiences are responsive phenomena.
Oh, absolutely. No, I think it's hugely important. And I think we should, when I start thinking about the turning outward part of it, how to navigate that landscape is important but complicated.
It's complicated.
You know, and that's where you have skills that I don't have. I mean, you understand it more. But I have an unfair advantage because my grandfather is a Baptist preacher.
That is true.
And my great-grandfather.
It's in the blood.
Yeah.
It's in the blood.
Yes. I know what it looks like. Okay?
My grandfather's on both sides of preachers, but they're not Baptist, so they,
no, okay.
you know.
Different flavor.
Methodist, wishy-washy.
Christian light.
Just a question, you guys. I mean, I'm not convinced, but I'm Jewish, but I managed to get to college without knowing the differences, anything about the differences between the different Protestant faiths.
Yeah.
I knew nothing. I just knew the Catholics. Catholics, not Catholics.
Catholics.
And Protestant.
Yeah.
And Jews.
Yeah.
And the rest of the world.
Yeah. Yeah, I have to say.
I want to come back, if I may, for
just
something about people hungering for the kind of aliveness, right? And this is a response to, it's a response to reductionism. As a response to the digitalization of everything. This book that I'm trying to write is one effort to say, but we are enchanted. We really are.
Yeah.
And we really are alive. And being alive
is
not something that you're going to get without understanding holes.
Yeah.
I mean, I talked about constraint closure last night, this idea of Giuseppe's two young colleagues.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's a holism.
Yeah.
It isn't in the parts, it's in the whole.
Yeah.
And there's about three or four others of like constraint closure, catalytic closure, a bunch of other things. That really is why we're alive.
Yes.
And since the becoming is unpredictable, that's enchantment.
That's enchantment.
Yeah.
Yeah. I absolutely agree with this, and I think that the simplistic breakdowns culturally between the materialists who think of themselves as encountering the really real and the anti-moderns who think they're encountering the really real. I think there's a way in which there needs to be a cut across all of this. That's a return to realism in the sense that we believe that we're making claims, albeit maybe theoretical and hypothetical, but informed, warranted claims about the nature of the kinds of systems that we're studying, and that they have these features that don't require the kinds of cultural trade-offs that we presume.
The seduction of modernism is too great. And it sort of sneaks back up anytime you have this temptation to disqualify something. You know?
Say more. What do you mean?
Well, you could just, I notice that, New Materialism, for example, New Materialist movements, and you guys have your version of anthropology and so forth, right?
The ontological.
The ontological term.
Can you take such for just a mere violence, what's New Materialism?
Well,
your work.
No. I mean, new materialism.
No, but that's what the new materialism love this stuff.
Love this stuff, right? I mean, but it's a sort of one way of framing it is that there is this sort of, at least in critical theory and philosophy, there's been this sort of overwhelming response to the domination of sort of cultural approaches, cultural, linguistic, historical approaches to the understanding of material organization, right? So you might think in different ways that these cultures sort of dominate the kind of epistemological frameworks that are possible. So for example, if you have one target has been like Derrida or linguistic term, something like that, where everything becomes framed through something like language. Everything becomes framed through historic materialism. Or something like that, right? So there's been, at least in critical theory and philosophy, there's been this incredible backlash that, look, we don't know how to talk about science.
We what?
Don't know how to talk about science. We don't know how to talk about physics. We don't know how to talk about biology.
Let alone reality, whatever the hell we think we do about that.
Because it's always produced, it's always constructed, and it's constructed through these sort of cultural, historical, linguistic mechanisms that are deeply human. Right.
So we can't talk about natural science.
Yeah, we can't talk about
it. Because natural science, in some sense, is about that which is not constructed.
Right, so there's been
although it might become.
Exactly. So there's
biology isn't constructed.
Exactly.
Because it's itself in a different
there's way. There's this new embrace of this kind of, there are various, there are different versions of it, but the humanity is trying to make room for the sciences. So they invent these new kinds of ontologies, new kinds of metaphysics, that can say, okay, well, we can have human culture, and we can have its various instantiations, but we can also have scientific knowledge production, we can have matter, we can have physics, we can have whatever. But they embrace it in these very large-scale ontologies, these ontological frameworks, and they actually are very seductive in some ways. They can be seductive. Some of them are a little bit more like clunky, like object-oriented ontology, something like that, but some of them are like, okay, look at this is deeply vitalistic. There's like vital materialisms, right? And everyone wants to say that's okay and that's great, but it reeks of a kind of sort of, there's this modern temptation to sort of reduce everything to this kind of framework. And this repositions the philosopher, because it's generally the philosopher who has the sort of ability to stand back from this world and make these kinds of develop the concepts that can be generative and accommodating, right? But this is, I think this is, it's taken over a lot of sort for a while, you know, it was kind of like the avant-garde thing to do. It was very avant-garde to be talking about this sort of stuff because no one had been talking about it for a while. And there's a sort of reinvention of metaphysics, right? Because metaphysics was sort of outmoded, right?
And then metaphysics were kind of halfway house that like got you back to the stuff that you thought you were missing. So a much cruder way of putting the same thing is 19th century, I'm a good modern, I want to be able to speak the truth, I have to become a secular.
Yep.
In order to become a secular, I have to become disenchanted. In order to become disenchanted, I need to become a reductive materialist. The price to be paid for speaking the truth as a modern means I give up magic, I give up vitality, and I probably give up the divine.
Right.
Maybe spirituality as a practice along the way. And the materialists don't have any reason, any compelling reason within their own intellectual traditions to stop being materialists, but they really want magic back. And they really want vitalism back, and they really want a life that they can live that's meaningful. And so I think these are a whole series of nested experiments in trying to find vitality and enchantment without giving up the truth.
That's genuinely what I hope I'm going to write this new book about, my mere 80 pages, and I don't think it's adequate to the task. But let me try this on you guys, if I may. Because I've got this talk that's sitting on my computer that I'll give to Paul and Sarah, and you haven't heard it. And it's entitled something like Beyond Physics, the Emergence and the Origin and Evolution of Life. It's almost the title of my book, and it's about 43 slides. In 15 slides into it, I say vitalism again. Mm-hmm. And why is vitalism stupid? Well, because we did the experiment that showed that you could make organic chemicals by natural chemistry. Whoever made, I can't remember what it was. But you know, since 1840s or somebody made some organic molecule in the lab, and I can't remember the molecule. So we think, in one important sense, it's true. Life is nothing but physics and chemistry. But it leaves out the fact that life is organized in a very specific way, and it's that organization that confers on life the fact that it's life. Mm-hmm. It's that organization of dynamical process by which you have a physical thing that literally constructs itself, and to use Mateo and Miles' frame. One of them is, it does work to construct constraints that on the release of energy, release of energy is work, mm-hmm. that is used to construct more constraints, mm-hmm. which are boundary conditions, such that the whole thing constructs themselves. This is their gorgeous idea. I got 80% of the way there, but I sure didn't get it. Now just think of that for a moment. Yeah. Let it sink in. This is matter constructing itself.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
By constructing its own, and this is Giuseppe saying, the very specific conditions of the boundary conditions of a living system builds its own boundary conditions.
Yes.
In physics, in Newton, you have the initial conditions and you have the boundary conditions, but you don't know where the boundary conditions come from. God gives you the boundary conditions, the billiard table is the boundary conditions. Through its work, living things build their own highly specific boundaries. A rabbit makes a rabbit. A rabbit doesn't make a daffodil.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Yeah.
Well, we're beginning to see, and then I'm repeating myself, but feel it and see what you say. So another thing that is true of Mile and Mateo's thing is that process one creates the constraints on the release of energy in process two that does it for process three, which is process one. So I'll close on. Well, each of those things is a work task. It's a thermodynamic actual fucking work task.
Okay.
So it's an actual work task. It's not some imaginary thing. It's a work task. And there's a set of M of them, and they all get done. And it closes on itself. It achieves a work task closure. Okay? That's a whole. It's not, none of the parts have the closure.
Right.
The whole has the property. Can you feel it?
Yes, exactly.
Okay. Yeah. Now, make an autocatalytic set. It's a set of molecules, so I catalyze Shinwei's formation out of Shinwei parts. He does it for you, Adam, and you do it for me. Cut two of you off. Okay, so that's an autocatalytic set.
Mm-hmm.
It achieves catalytic closure. all the tasks that have to get catalyzed are catalyzed, right. But I don't catalyze my formation, I catalyze this formation. We have a non-local, holistic property. I think living things have all those three properties plus one more. It's putting them now in a liposome, the little soap bubble thingy, and the liposome now gives it a closure, the physical closure, creating an inside and an outside.
Yeah.
We're not far from populism.
Yeah.
And there's nothing mysterious going on.
Yeah,
we just haven't seen
there's
it.
There's something wondrous going on, but not mysterious going on.
Yeah.
And the,
right.
What I would add to that...
But seriously, can you feel it?
Yeah, I feel it. And I think the part of its potency with regard to this cultural appetite that has multiple expressions, not least new materialism, or at least part of new materialism, is that the actualization of these processes, these... autocatalytic, autopoetic features of living things, the vital nature of living things, changes the relationship, our relationship to physics and chemistry, which is to say, it's not just now that physics and chemistry are all there is that converge in a complex manner and give you life. It's that once you get the actualization of life, you know you can read the nature of physics and chemistry as potentia for life.
Right. Good.
So all of the universe becomes vital in its potentia.
Right. And that's my being stunned by the idea that what if there are 10 to the 22 biospheres out there
and
becoming?
This,
and they're all,
and,
they're
and,
all to use our...
This matters to me because I think philosophically, against the reductive materialists, the idea is all of reality is dead and life is the exception.
Mm-hmm.
But in fact, life is the actualization that is the key to understanding the significance of the physics and the chemistry.
That's great. I love it. Right.
And then that is the what? Letting the biological concept become normative for
right.
certain conversations about physics
right.
and chemistry instead of physics and chemistry only
yes,
being normative for
right.
biology.
Right.
That's
so,
what Longo's calling for too.
Yeah, so I have fun with the poem that I might have told a couple of you guys in this book. Jeffrey West is a friend of the Santa Fe. He's a brilliant, brilliant guy. And on his 70th or 75th birthday, he's a physicist, and he was giving a talk, and most of the institute is full of physicists. So here's Jeffrey's talk. He said, of course, if biologists had been with Galileo, they'd have had red stones and blue stones and green stones and yellow stones to see which would fall faster. And everybody laughed. It's the perfect physicist joke about how stupid biologists are. So in the prologue to this book, I put it in and managed to put it in line to write. But of course, the red stones are redwood trees, the blue stones are
right.
sea urchins, the green stones are sea slugs, and the yellow stones are us. The question isn't what falls faster, it's how do we come to be?
Yeah.
And it is.
Yeah. Yeah.
And why physicists can't be stunned by that?
Yeah. Yeah.
For all that I mean, I adore physics, but why can't they be stunned by that?
Yeah. Well, because, I don't know, I have a hunch, though, that they have a very different set of questions that they're asking.
Okay.
You know, what counts for knowledge in that? I mean, this is one of the things that sort of motivates a lot of my work, and no matter what it's on, is the sort of the kinds of questions and the constraints that are generative for each of these different domains, right? So,
mm-hmm.
you know, biologists are asking, I mean, unfortunately, I feel like too often biologists are, especially theoretical biologists, are asking questions that are relevant for physicists and chemists, but not necessarily relevant for biologists, or maybe
mm-hmm.
To do the kind of work that physicists and chemists want biologists to do for them, right? But
I'm guilty of that. I've done that for most of my career.
So I mean, so it becomes really true. It becomes interesting to sort of generate, be attentive to that, but also be not think that physicists have to become biologists, but to become aware of the fact that the kind of questions that physicists and chemists are asking, and you know, information scientists or whatever, what motivates the kinds of that's precisely what motivates the kinds of solutions that are productive for them. And that's okay, but it's not to mobilize the kinds of, you know, things that physicists find interesting and say, well, this has to work in this domain, this has to work in this domain as well, right? So when I said that I'm really, really interested in sort of, you know, the domains of philosophical practice, but also biological practices and the kinds of concepts that they generate, it's to actually start teasing out what are those, you know, what are those separations, and not be like, okay, well, we can't move across borders and boundaries and so forth, but actually being able to say, Like I can look at Michael and go, okay, look at, he's interested in what the physicist is interested in. I'm interested in what, you know, these practices are interested in. How can we have a conversation? Not like my shit trumps yours because
right.
I can accommodate you.
Exactly.
And you can't accommodate me.
Exactly.
But there's what you're saying is absolutely right. Although there is a kind of secessionary cultural payoff that's to secede from the dominant games in that, and I'm thinking Hans Jonas, 1963, Life, Death, and the Body,
yeah.
Beautiful essay in which he says, so I'm reading the essay now, thinking about what Stu has just said. You know, we used to think the whole world was alive and we didn't know what to fucking do with the corpse. And so we came up with all these crazy rituals about like, the corpse isn't really dead.
Right.
And in fact, it turns out it's not. It's like all these biodynamical putrefaction processes. It's just this organism has left this form. And he says, and then fast forward a few thousand years and like the corpse isn't the problem anymore. Life is the problem because all of reality is dead. And now how the hell do you explain the way life comes out of it? And so, you know, with no proportions guarded, the kind of speech act that Stu just gave us is a world historical moment which says, fuck it, actually we just discovered that in fact these things which we thought were not alive are alive.
Mm-hmm.
But they may only be alive in their potency, but that doesn't mean... Right.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
But it means that whatever else is, we're not in this mode of reductive materialism which says the only way we can explain living things is concatenations of dead things.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And by the way, you know, just the way we define life, like, I love the idea of contextualizing living systems via this notion of autocatalytic sets, right? But I think I mentioned this before, last time we met when we were in Santa Fe. You know, you could describe an atom the same way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, an atom expends energy in order to constrain the potential for another state of the atom, another component of the atom, however you want to define it. And it's an atom is a complex structure. But why isn't an atom alive if it can be defined this way? Because an atom evolves, an atom has potentia, an atom is not determined, predetermined. It unfolds its own history via the same types of external constraints that living systems have, and the same type of internal constraints that living systems have.
Well, we've had this conversation.
Mm-hmm.
What about atoms? What about stars? What about galaxies? Yeah.
So why isn't an atom alive in its own way? I'm not saying it's sentient or conscious, but...
One answer that you might throw out, and I don't want to say atoms alive, is that living things can evolve and atoms can't.
How do we know?
You know,
how do we know atoms
can
evolve?
Even atoms seem to be except through, you know, nucleosynthesis and stuff.
So, I'm sorry?
Well, I mean, a helium atom stays a helium atom.
How do you know? We don't know enough about the internal structure of an atom to say that there's a sort of a defining characteristic that.
Yeah,
all,
you might be right.
But isn't there a sense in which this both sides, both the autocatalytic stuff and your description of the atom and its own life history, it begins to erode what's at stake in the answer to the question, what's inanimate and what's animate?
Right.
Like it turns out that less turns on that than we thought it did. Because in fact, the paper that you circulated, that you guys had worked on, whatever else that gave to me was the sense that reality itself is a bearer of experience.
Yeah.
The fact that every actuality, standing behind every actuality is a host of potentia, which are actual in a non-technical sense of actual, like are real.
Yeah, they're real.
And we treat them as real, means that there's something about the very nature of reality itself which bears experience, and the experience is tacit in the fact that the potential became actual.
Yes, yes.
It has,
and
in that sense, in that sense, it has bios in the Greek sense, because bios in the Greek sense was not the thing that made a plant the same as an animal. It was the bio as in biography,
right?
Something that has a history, and it bears a kind of subjectivity.
What bios means, it has a history.
Yeah, that it has a life story.
It's life.
What is the category? Story?
So that's why I was saying...
It's a category about life, but it's a kind of existential category.
So that's why I was suggesting in the talk, but also in this conference, in this setting, that maybe in notions like duration, life, and living, and material could be thought of as aspects of being rather than a category.
Like, I love it.
Yeah,
yes.
That's right.
Yeah,
I like that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And by the way, that's very Whiteheadian. I mean, that's what Whitehead would say is you can have the atom is alive.
Yeah.
And to greater or less degree.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And it's actually
in a different manner.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, exactly. The animists say this too. I mean, the best contemporary work in anthropology on one level is a return to Amerindian mm-hmm. anthropologies to say, like, you know, why did you have to go through a ceremony? In order to kill and eat the deer, I have to go through a ceremony in which I become accountable. Mm-hmm. Why? Because the deer is alive and I'm alive. Mm-hmm. And I'm not allowed to eat this thing that's also alive unless I'm accountable. Mm-hmm. You know?
Is that true?
Yeah, this is true. Mm-hmm. This is a really beautiful book.
Are many tribes or just one tribe or what?
Cannibal Metaphysics. It's pretty, the author argues it's pretty diffuse, and he's a pretty good anthropologist, so
yeah.
I'll disagree.
But there's many tribes or many tribes or just one unique tribe or what?
He wants to say generally in North American Indians, you see the ritual practices around the killing and eating of an animal are in part a ceremony to deal with the fact that there's a shared brotherhood that has to be overcome in order for you to consume this animal. It has to be suspended in a certain way.
I've lived in the strangest way. I mean, after all, we go to the market, we buy our food, right?
Yeah.
So we're rather distant from the fact that something got slaughtered.
Yeah.
This summer I caught a bunch of crabs. I've caught crabs many times. And I killed the crabs. So I took a cleaver and fought through 7 crabs. I don't want any crabs anymore.
Yeah.
I killed them.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mind you, I'm not a vegetarian, but I kind of prefer to be a vegetarian.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's the same thing.
The very decanter says.
It's the awareness of the fact that crab is just as fucking alive as I am.
Yeah, that's right.
Who am I to kill that crab
so
I can, you know, you know.
He says, DeCastro, who wrote this book, says, look, it's clear that what becomes in the European encounter with the American Indian, what they were trying to make sense of is they've got different bodies, so do they have a similar soul?
Mm.
And the Amerindian perspective is this inverse of it, which is like they has a different body, but I know he has the same soul
mm-hmm.
because he's alive.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is, I mean, it's just a different way to get at the Whiteheadian point. Is like the question isn't whether or not the atom is alive, using that term loosely.
Mm-hmm.
The question is, what is the manner in which?
Right.
And the manner in which is different and can be specified and carries different valences and different values. But the analytic cut isn't, nothing turns on the analytic cut of saying, well, the atom's not alive, I am.
Right. Yeah, I mean, for Whitehead, really the only difference between an atom and a conscious being, let's say, let's just go from, you know, forget alive, conscious, sentient living systems, is the complexity of the prehensions and the complexity of the constructions of prehensions. So you go from simple, pure physical prehensions, which like an electron is going to undertake, where it literally just copies what it inherited from its antecedent state. Nothing new, really.
Although it thereby has a history.
It has a history, and there's a possibility of reversion, but it's generally just going to reproduce its antecedent state. Then you have hybrid prehensions, where essentially what is brought into the realm of possibility for the new electron in process is not only its antecedent state, but also the antecedent state that was either unactualized, unrealized. That's why I was saying, you know, we have to, I don't know if you were here for that, but the weird thing about quantum mechanics via the topological formulation is that you have histories of not only events, you have histories of the contexts of each event. Those are also preserved. And the histories of unactualized potentia that get preserved. So there's a record.
How does the history get preserved of the unactualized?
Because every novel event, every novel, say in this case measurement event, or why that was the actual occasion and process, is internally related to the totality of all extant actual occasions.
It's internally related to all prior possibilities.
Yeah, and prior without reference to time, it just sort of means that that's what these dative actualities, it's sort of like as soon as a fact comes into being, it never goes away. There's no erasure of fact.
Yeah.
And the question is, how is the fact stored? Where is it preserved? Well, it's where the history of the universe is preserved in each actual occasion. And the question why? The reason is because of the presupposed a priori desideratum that every actual occasion must be capable of logical integration with every other throughout the entirety of every history. Meaning, you don't ever have a violation of non-contradiction. You can't have, like, if this cup is here, it's the same as saying it's nowhere else in the universe.
Yeah.
Can we test it? No.
And so all the possibilities have to be actualized as that one.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Which means that all the unactualized possibilities, like on Venus, when a grain of dust is about to, you know, actualize this way or that way, one of those unrealized potentia must be connectable to the system history of this room and this cup, so that actualizations of measurements here can be logically integrated with those anywhere else.
Yeah.
And it's sort of like, scientifically, this is not testable, we don't care. But it's like Russell's teacup or teapot argument, where it's like, prove that there's not a teapot orbiting Mars.
Well, mid-20th century anthropology was fascinated by the fact that, quote unquote, the primitive mentality understood reality as participatory. That is, all ontologies participate in all of our ontologies.
Oh, wonderful. That's amazing. So, but that means that there's a role for unrealized potentia. And then scientifically,
there's a history of unrealized.
Yes, exactly. And here's the amazing thing, so I can prove it. I can prove it because the wonderful thing about quantum mechanics is it's statistical. So that you have you can't prove anything with one measurement of that. No more than you can prove that you've got a fair coin if you toss it just one time. You gotta toss it 10 or 12 times and see that it's actually a fair coin. That's what the problem lizards are. So what happens is, when systems continue to, you know, actualize via measurement, just like the unactualized probabilities are still constitutive of the entirety of the probability distribution, so that the actualized probability at the end is affected by the unactualized probabilities. That's what makes probabilities work.
Its actuality consists of the entire probability.
Yeah, exactly. They all have to sum to one. So that means that even the unrealized probabilities are still they're still relevant. In fact, more than that, they define the actualized.
That's right.
What if we do history?
Because there are all the sort of conditions of possibility for the actualization of the thing that got actualized.
Yeah, exactly. So now if we do history sequences of events, like statistical ensembles, then it really becomes obvious that it doesn't matter if the last iteration, the card I drew was not a face card. Like, I'm counting cards. This is obvious. If it's intuitive, I'm a card counter in Vegas. I know that, like, if 5 cards ago I didn't get a face card, that unactualized potential is super relevant now because it affects the probability distribution I'm interested in now. And physical systems are no different, which means that, you know, the road not taken is still going to affect the choice of road the next time.
Yeah.